Hello, everybody. Welcome to Cloud Cover Show. Today, I'm joined by Bruno and Mark Fassel to talk about the Cirrus Fabric. But before I turn it to you, because Bruno is new on our team, I'll just let you to introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Bruno Medina. I come from Mexico, and I'm new in the team. And I'm going to be working here with the guys at TED in the X-Corp. And we're going to hopefully be present in a lot of more of these shows, like the one that we're going to have today.
Awesome. Welcome to the team.
Thank you.
So today, we are going to do one episode on Cirrus Fabric, but this is only the first episode of a three-episode series. So today, we have Mark Fassel to do the introduction for us. Then we'll have an episode on containers, and we'll have one on Cirrus Fabric running on Linux. So mm-hmm. it'll be great. And also, on November 4th, we will have an 8-hour live broadcast of Cirrus Fabric.
Eight hours?
Yes. So it will be a lot of Cirrus Fabric coming in, and we'll send out notice shortly after this. So now I think we are ready to get started because we have a lot to cover.
We have a lot to cover, yes.
So Mark, why don't you introduce yourself and get started?
So my name is Mark Fassel, and I'm a program manager that works on the Azure Service Fabric team. Mm-hmm. I've worked on Service Fabric for a number of years. And I'm super excited to be here because I love talking about this topic showing developers what we can do with it.
Yeah, we've been wanting to do Cirrus Fabric episodes for a long time, but finally we got around to do this. I'm excited as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let me talk to you about it all. Right. So, you know, when we start building things for the cloud, and we found this a lot inside Microsoft, there were so many cloud things you had to think about in order to build a native application. You had to think about the fact you didn't own your hardware, mm-hmm. failures were prevalent in machines, scale was unpredictable. You know, you wouldn't wanted to go from 1 million users to 10 million users without redesigning your app. We found more than anything that building an app and deploying it was one thing, but managing the whole life cycle of how you upgrade, deploy, and think about the whole life cycle of your app became an exercise in itself. We invested a lot of time about the life cycle management, the DevOps side of these things. Mm-hmm. How you dealt with no downtime, upgrades, security, and most of all, you know, we needed to build a platform where it made developers productive building applications, not building infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you just deal with raw VMs, you're dealing just with infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so that eventually led us down this path, what is now known inside the industry as sort of a microservices mm-hmm. approach. And this has emerged inside the industry, and it happened to be what we also built inside Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And really it comes down to two things. The first is that we had to build services that were continuously evolving. We had to add new features, we had to fix bugs, we had to roll out upgrades each week. And the other thing is we had to build services that could run at scale. And that meant that you could start small, maybe 3 machines, but then grow to 30, 300, and grow in scale. Mm-hmm. And you had this continuous delivery of these things. And if you read a lot inside industry now, this microservices approach is becoming very related to how we build these cloud-native applications. So, you know, it's good to kind of talk about what that means. Traditionally, when you built apps, we very much thought about the hardware that you had, and you had sort of a database server, and you sort of had middle tier servers, and you had a front-end web server. And teams built a bunch of code, and they spent some time testing it and deployed it to these set of machines. Yep. And there's some advantages, there's many advantages about this, but there are some disadvantages as well. With a microservices approach and sort of building cloud-native applications, mm-hmm. what the approach is instead is you have a pool of machines, a sort of a cluster. Mm-hmm. They tend to be general purpose. And then you build a set of applications or microservices that can be deployed across those set of machines. Mm-hmm. And each one is independently scalable, versionable, upgradable. And this allows you to have the agility of updating different pieces of code at different times, mm-hmm. And also scale things independently.
Yes. So can we see there's a clear separation between your application workload and the infrastructure. So basically, you write your application so that it can be deployed on any pool of resources on the cloud. You are not designing for a specific machine or specific configuration.
True, that's very clear.
You're looking into services instead of machines.
Exactly, this is very true. Yeah, separating out the fact that you want a pool of machines mm-hmm. that you don't have to babysit and manage, mm-hmm. and yet you're building an application, and then you should let the system decide, oh, this is the machine it's best to run on, or this machine's died, and I'll move it over here. Mm-hmm. And making all those decisions on your behalf, rather than you having to make all those decisions about, you know, my database server's gone down, oh, what do I do next? Mm-hmm. In your traditional application design, you had to componentize things. In the microservices design, you tend to split those all apart mm-hmm. and have them independently upgradable and deployable. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you know, there are benefits of a traditional design where you get runtime contracts and a compiler helps you mm-hmm. and it's simpler to think about.
Okay.
But in a In microservices design, you get this agility and the ability to scale things independently. That's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. I think for the microservices, we are encouraging people to decompose the application into separate services, right?
Yes.
So does the SOAR, the service-oriented architecture. They are encouraging to build services and trust them together into applications. So what's the main difference you see between SOA and microservices?
Well, I think there's a lot of debate about the subtleties of this. But to me, I think when we talked about SOA, we usually mostly talked around the contracts, the protocols, how mm-hmm. things communicated between those services. Mm-hmm. And in SOA talked less about the operational side of it all, the deployment, the upgrade, the containerization of your apps, mm-hmm. And of how you dealt with failovers and redeployment and other things. So to me, microservices adds on top of SOA mm-hmm. this concept of deployment, scale, upgrade, versioning mm-hmm. that you can place into your set of machines mm-hmm. And you know, brings it more into how you build cloud applications.
Okay. Cool. So SOA is mostly about the composition of services, how you structure pretty much in a static view, how your application is composed. But microservice, on the other hand, is more about how you operate that services at scale and how to organize them together.
Well, I think it encompasses both. Certainly when you build a microservice, it's very important still to think about the contracts. Mm-hmm. Okay. In fact, that's the thing that becomes more difficult. You know, you have to be very conscious about how I communicate from one service to another. It's very important to put versioning on the protocol so you can roll out new versions of your microservice and not have failures inside those systems. So I think you still think about that.
Pretty much the whole DevOps context behind it and how do you pull these things together, right?
Yes, and so I think, yeah, so but microservices gives you the, tends to think more around the business of what you're doing. So you're decomposing your application into pieces of scalable independent code that you can version. So right. I think it just extends SOA in my mind and takes it to a way where we think about building these things for the cloud, where we have a general pool of machines that we deploy these things to.
Cool. Makes sense.
Another thing that happens a lot, what we found inside a microservices approach, is where you manage all your state. Very typically and traditionally, you stick everything inside a database. Made it very simple to think about. I had mm-hmm. sort of tables, primary key, foreign key relationships between it all. I knew all my data was there. I could do my query analytics on it all. Yep. And it's still perfectly valid as a choice. But when you start to scale up and have this independence of services, we also found that you had to separate the state independently. Mm-hmm. So this workflow had to deal with its state management, or this cache service does it with its state management. And separating those out, it gives you more complexity that your state is distributed, but it gives you the agility to independently upgrade those different things. So we focused a lot inside Service Fabric about whether your state is, whether you choose Service Fabric as a platform or not, you have to think about this model.
Okay. I think that this is a somewhat of departure from what developers used to think about. We used to think about all my data is in the database. I feel safe the data is in the database. But now we are basically saying you can keep the state close to the compute themselves and you can have distributed state in your application.
Yes, I think the important thing is to distribute the state. I mean, there are still perfectly valid cases where you have a piece of code running here and it pulls your state from, say, DocDB or from some other externalized store. And those are, we call those stateless services. They're very common. Inside Service Fabric, and I'll demonstrate this, we went one step further and we actually allowed you to bring the state next to your compute and we made Service Fabric a storage technology as well. Mm-hmm. So it's both a storage and a compute technology. But we have many examples of teams that just simply build stateless services and they put their state in different repositories, in Azure Database or in Azure Tables. Mm-hmm. And that works well. It's just don't bundle it all into one place because that constrains how you do your upgrades. Yeah.
Okay.
So this all led to effectively us building a microservices platform in Mike. And what you want to be able to have is what's a platform that can help you along this approach so that you can build things that run in this approach. And what you want to be able to do is have a platform where you can bring your own frameworks, your own programming languages, your own skill set to it all. And you'd love that platform as well to be used in many, many different environments. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly the objectives and goals that we had and set for Azure Service Fabric. It spans everything from the developer side of things, providing you programming models, all the way through to the ops side of things. It creates a pool of cluster of machines, and it manages the deployment of those applications. It gives you rich diagnostics. It gives you health monitoring around them. There's all the resource allocation. And you can take this platform, and I'll show you in a moment, you can either set this up inside Azure and create a what we call a cluster that you can deploy to, or you can take Service Fabric and just take a set of Windows Server machines and bolt them together with a network and build my own little cluster under my desk or in your own data center. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is proving very popular that people can create their own data centers using Service Fabric.
Cool.
I showed actually in Build how you can take that and you can deploy and Service Fabric into other clouds.
Into
if you
other
wanna,
clouds, another that's guy, amazing.
You can do that. And then, just as importantly, I can put Service Fabric on my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And the bits that run on my laptop are exactly the same that ones run in Azure, that run on-premise, mm-hmm. and it's exactly the same experience you get. So there's none of this friction that you get with some emulator that mm-hmm. pretends to be Azure or that sort of stuff. So this is a great experience. It runs everywhere.
Cool.
It's called Dream for the developers out there.
Yes, the development experience has been very popular and what it looks like. So creating, what happens then is you end up creating a cluster in one of these environments.
Mm-hmm.
You deploy Service Fabric to this. Either this is done for you inside Azure or it's a PowerShell command on-premise. And mm-hmm. that joins together and becomes a cluster of machines.
Mm-hmm.
I've shown five here, but you can have as many as you want. You can go into thousands. And then, in the Azure world, you typically connect to that through the Azure Load Balancer, and you deploy your code package across each set of machines. And Service Fabric has all the smarts to know where to deploy your code and how to run it.
Mm-hmm.
Then typically, a client request will come into the Azure Load Balancer, and it'll redirect it to wherever your code is running.
Mm-hmm.
And Service Fabric will find out where your code is running and redirect all the requests to it all. Mm-hmm. So it has the smarts to know how to route the request to the message. It has like a DNS inside the cluster. We call it the naming service mm-hmm. that tells you where to find your piece of code.
Is there a concept of a master node where you have to talk to first?
No, there isn't. Service Fabric has a set of machines mm-hmm. that you deploy into a cluster, and you can actually talk to any one of the machines and find out what's happening inside the cluster. So other systems have this sort of master node and slave nodes.
Yeah.
You'll see that what we talk about is the system services in Service Fabric get distributed across your set of machines.
Okay.
Maybe in large clusters, you can decide to push those onto a particular set of machines. You can choose to do that, mm-hmm. but it runs inside your cluster. Let me show you.
I see.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to switch over to Azure Portal here.
Yeah.
And what I can do inside the Azure Portal is I can create a cluster. So if I go new and scroll down and create a new resource here, what I'm going to do is create a new Service Fabric cluster.
Mm-hmm.
And what I can do is I can add in a new name for a cluster. I'm going to call this test. Because Service Fabric actually deploys onto a set of VMs, you can have actually direct access to the VMs inside your cluster. So it lives in this interesting world of being a service, but at the same time, you can actually access all the VMs inside your cluster and deploy whatever you want to it all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, and that gives you lots of advantages because you can have your own VM image if you want, or you can deploy your own VM extensions.
Mm-hmm. And I guess because this is this cluster is deployed as a resource group, you can actually go to the resource group and do some customization. Like if you want to define additional network security group,
yes.
can you do that?
Oh, you can do that very much so. In fact, it's we're setting this up. We've published lots and lots of templates onto the Azure Template Gallery
mm-hmm.
That sets up a cluster that's behind network security groups that's mm-hmm. secure. So you only expose the ports for your application,
okay.
And you can lock that down. And we have many different types of cluster configurations, particularly focused on security, yes.
Okay.
It's a very common thing. So as you see here, what I've gone and done is I've said I'm going to create a cluster. I can choose a number of what I call node types. Mm-hmm. Service Fabric is built on VM scale sets. So you can scale out any one of the node types from VM scale sets. And here I could choose any one of the series of VMs I have inside here. And I can choose, the DV2 series inside here, and then I'm able to scale out as many of those VMs I want inside here. Although inside our portal it has 50 nodes here, this is just a restriction inside the portal. You can make this the limits of VM scale set. Mm-hmm. And I could add another one inside here as well. So if I wanted to, I can also add a second node type inside here. Mm-hmm. So I could say, I want to put a node type 2 inside here. So I can have a cluster that consists of mm-hmm. some A3s and some D4s. Mm-hmm. And what's clever about that is that you make put just your web workloads on the smaller machines, but all your heavier processing workloads on the other. Mm-hmm. So this mixed cluster of VMs allows you to choose all of this.
And can you override that amount of VMs, the capacity?
Yes, I can choose any, as in the number I have inside here.
Yeah.
Yes, you can choose any number of VMs that you want mm-hmm. inside there. So I can have, you know, I can go up to hundreds if I want inside here. And then you can also scale those VMs up and down. So it's very common to be able to say, I'm going to scale my cluster up from 10 machines up to 20 machines. Mm-hmm. And then maybe at the weekend, I can scale it all back down again to save myself costs. Yep. And that's just done through the ARM model. I mean, I show this inside the portal here, but this is all through the Azure resource model about how I can change the number of instances, set the security inside all of this. And then if I do this, effectively, what I end up getting is I end up getting a cluster deployed. Mm-hmm. And as you say, that's deployed as an Azure resource group. Mm-hmm. And then I can connect to that cluster. And built into the cluster, we have what's called our Azure Service Fabric, our Azure Service Fabric Explorer. Mm-hmm. And this gives me a view of attached to this cluster here. You see, this is the one of my URL here in East US.
Okay. And so when you deploy a cluster, you automatically get this portal?
I do, yes.
Okay.
I get this portal because it's built into any of the VMs or the nodes I connect to, and it renders this as a web page inside it all. Oh. Okay. So it's a web page portal built with AngularJS that does all this lovely rendering of what I can see as my system. And I'll show you in a moment, when I switch over to my dev machine, I have exactly the same portal on my dev machine. So if I look inside here, you'll see that this is my overall view. It shows the number of applications I've deployed, the number of nodes. Mm-hmm. I can look at these nodes here, and you'll see that, if I just zoom in here a moment, you'll see that, you know, here's the list of the IP addresses on my cluster. Mm-hmm. You'll see that they're striped across upgrade domains and fault domains. The fault domains are the physical racks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, each rack is I picked a VM from. In fact, there's a great cluster, in fact, there's a great view that you can see inside here. If I go to cluster and I go up to cluster map, here it sees the striping mm-hmm. of my fault domains across different VMs. Mm-hmm. And then the upgrade domains is how I do a rollout for changes of my application. Mm-hmm. So if I say roll out my change, it'll roll across each one of those machines and in a controlled fashion do a new deployment. So all of this is just given to you as a cluster inside Azure, and you have this this scalable cluster of a pool of machines. And we know all the smarts about this cluster as well, mm-hmm. in terms of the number of resources it uses, the amount of disk space, the amount of memory and things. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, was there a master node and what does it all look like? Mm-hmm. Well, these are the system services here that run inside the cluster. The naming service does everything about discovering where any particular piece of code is running.
Are these services running in all the nodes?
Yes, in fact, if you look at them, we actually use our own technology to build a distributed, highly available set of services that run across each one of the machines. So you see here, it actually is distributed across all the machines inside the cluster. So if machine number one was to go down, my system services keep running because it's all highly available inside here. And these services do all the intelligence of an image store, has all the binaries that I deploy my application packages to. The naming service is like DNS inside the cluster. It discovers where everything is running. The failover manager service deals with if a machine fails or a process fails or restart things. Mm-hmm. And the cluster manager service deals with the lifecycle rollout, deployments, upgrades, versioning.
Versioning of cluster itself or the applications on the cluster?
Actually, the versioning of cluster itself is inside Azure, so it's upgrade service.
Okay.
And what the great thing about running inside Azure mm-hmm. is that we come along and every 4 weeks upgrade the cluster. Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to choose whether you move forward to the next version of Service Fabric or back. Mm-hmm. But those, as far as you're concerned, there's an upgrade of the cluster's runtime binaries itself. But you just have to care about deploying your application.
I see. Mm-hmm. So if you provision the cluster on Azure, it's a managed cluster. We'll do the upgrade for you.
Correct.
But if you do on some other cloud platform, you need to manage that yourself.
You're on your own, yes. Okay. And it's the same as on-premise. But on-premise, it is a fairly simple exercise in that there's a single PowerShell command, and you download a new package. You say, upgrade Service Fabric cluster, here's the package. Mm-hmm. And will walk through the cluster doing it for you. Mm-hmm. It's just it's not managed for you. You have to do it yourself.
So even if you're upgrading the cluster itself, you're not bringing down the cluster. It's still doing a rolling upgrade.
Still rolling upgrade.
Your application is still running?
Yes. The time? In fact, all the time, VMs may be rebooting and being hosted underneath you, and mm-hmm. we coordinate with that. The cluster can be upgraded as you're rolling upgrade and your application keeps running, or you can be upgrading your application. And all of those get coordinated together mm-hmm. to make sure the availability of the app is always maintained.
Cool.
So these are the sort of things I talk about when you run a cloud-native service. Yep. These are sort of the hard problems we start to see.
Yeah. You don't have to worry about it as a developer.
Yes. We'll show how to build some applications in a moment, but this is my application view inside the cluster here. You see I've got this single app cluster monitor application deployed. And you can go down and see where an instance of this is running on each one of these different machines. Mm-hmm. And you can go and see the endpoint is deployed to. In fact, if I go and take this endpoint here, what I'll do is I'll take, if I go and take this URL at the top here, let me shrink this down a moment, and just open up a new tab. And if I go and do, that was called Cluster Monitor, I think it was. Here's a little application we deployed that just allows you to view, you know, the state of your application. So this is an application that shows the state of application. So this is mm-hmm. just a web app that runs, and you can see inside here all the applications running inside this cluster, and that just translates into the same view as you see inside here. But this application just helps you. This is one that gets deployed. But let's show how you build something for this.
Yeah, that looks interesting.
So let me just switch back here a moment. One question I get a lot mm-hmm. is the relationship between cloud services and service fabric.
Yes.
Cloud services is a great technology. Mm-hmm. You can build applications and deploy them into the cloud. Mm-hmm. But there were a few limitations that we had with it. One is that unlike Service Fabric, the app and the VM were tightly bound together. Mm-hmm. So it really was, you were deploying VMs with a piece of code inside them all. Yeah. So when you scaled out, you were adding new VMs and you're taking away VMs, it made it very slow. In the Service Fabric world, as I showed you, the cluster and the app are separate. So I can do really high density. I can pack hundreds and thousands of applications into my set of machines. And as I scale up and scale down, Service Fabric will just distribute the apps. So as a result of that, the separation of the cluster mm-hmm. from the application, you get very fast deployment times. I can deploy an app very quickly, upgrade it very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then as I mentioned already, and in fact about to show you, cloud services, first cloud services only ran in Azure, so you couldn't run it on premise. Mm-hmm. And then we had a one box experience that was an emulator inside cloud services, but Service Fabric is not like this. Mm-hmm. So quite often what we see actually, and we've seen a lot of this happening with people, is that they can take an existing cloud service deployment that may be talking to a set of other Azure services, mm-hmm. like Azure Cache Service or Table Store, and they can usually replace all of that with Service Fabric as the business logic in terms of where it runs, where a Service Fabric code or service, mm-hmm. as we call it, and a cloud service are effectively identical. But you get the benefits of fast deployment, scale out, high density. Yeah.
So in terms of migration, I remember when we do a cloud service, there's a web role and a worker role, and usually we tell people to use some kind of a queue between the roles to communicate.
Yes.
So do you apply the same pattern when you migrate to a Service Fabric?
Yes. In Service Fabric, we have this concept of stateless services and mm-hmm. stateful, and I'll spend some more time on those. But with the stateless ones, they're just like worker roles. So if you have a web application and you have and you have a stateless service that runs as well, you particularly want to, you can still put a queue between them all.
Okay.
But if you build stateful ones, you don't have to put a queue between them all. And I'll show you what the benefits will be, because what happens is the stateful one maintains all of the state highly available and replicated for all of that.
That's amazing.
Yes. So what we find in Service Fabric is you have a platform and you can bring your own code. Mm-hmm. We call it guest executables. You can take advantage of the built-in programming models we provide. Mm-hmm. You can also deploy web applications. We integrate very well with ASP.NET Core and OWN as application types that get deployed.
Mm-hmm. When you say guest executable, is that just .NET applications?
No, that could be anything. When we say desk,
what is anything?
Well, it could be like your own binary that you don't have the source code. Okay. It could be a Java virtual machine. It could be a Node.js application. Anything that you can start on Windows, effectively. Right. You can just say Service Fabric, deploy this thing, and it'll make it reliable.
And maybe in the episode number 3, we'll get to see that running also in Linux.
Yes,
we'll see that running in Linux, yes. So let me show you how you build an application. I'm going to switch over here to my dev machine.
Oh, this is the hello world moment.
This is the hello world
moment. Yeah, that's
yes.
What we were waiting for.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the hello world moment. So I'm going to do file, new project. File, new project. And inside here, you'll see that we have Service Fabric integrated as a set of templates. Mm-hmm. And if I create this, you'll see that I have stateless and stateful. The stateful one is one that makes it highly available and replicated. We have this actor programming model, which is a very interesting programming model where you have individual actors that represent a state of a device mm-hmm. or a person or things. Mm-hmm. This is very popular in terms of building
it's like
apps.
Really into the model, right? Like taking into consideration what would be probably like the object?
Yes, we find that actor programming model is very fits very well with a lot of IoT scenarios. Mm. Number of different companies have built solutions on Service Fabric where they've used actors to represent a car, or they've mm-hmm. represented a lighting system, or they've represented a workflow. And then you just say to Service Fabric, create a million of them, yeah. and they're all individually identifiable. You can do web applications, and this guest executable will just allow you to wrap an application and deploy it all. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do you the hello world moment on stateless services. And what this shows me here is it will create me a project over the side here, and you'll see that the project is an application, mm-hmm. and it consists of a number of services.
Okay.
And I can have any number of services I want in here. And here, this is our these are our microservices. I can have one at this point. I can have two, three. I can add many more.
Okay.
And the application is defined by this definition that describes the services it contains. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that this contains one stateless service. And then the service itself is defined by a definition here. And you see that everything's got versioning on it. It's got versioning on the service itself, versioning on the code package. And this definition just simply says, I'm going to deploy an executable.
Okay.
And that's all it is. It's just a piece of code. That includes, as well as configuration inside here. So one of the interesting parts about Service Fabric is the code and config are separate. Mm-hmm. So I can do a change to my code, I can do a change to my configuration.
Okay. So you can roll out the upgrade of configuration only without impacting the code?
Correct, yes, on a per service basis. Okay. So I can create this service, and I can just upgrade this code. That service can be part of the application, and I can just roll out changes for those.
Cool.
If I look at the programming model here, this is effectively the cloud services equivalent, you'll see that really there are just two simple methods. One, what we call here, create service instance listeners, which is how I talk to my service. Mm-hmm. And I can talk to this in any way I want, mm-hmm. TCP, HTTP. We provide some plug-in communication listeners for web API, mm-hmm. for WCF, for TCP, so that you can use those out of the box. But you can plug those in here, or you can build your own. And then really, you have this run async method here. Mm-hmm. And this is just your run method. Mm-hmm. You just write your code inside here, and then your code will run.
Right.
And inside this simple example here, you know, I just create a counter, I write out some diagnostics messages, and you know, I just loop around in creating this counter. So if I just deploy this onto my local machine, I have the Service Fabric SDK deployed inside here. Mm-hmm. I run PowerShell commands. It builds a package. It deploys it onto my local box. And you'll be able to see that if I switch over to the Explorer view here, this time you'll see that in the top here it says localhost.
Mm-hmm.
I have the same view as I had before. This is on my dev box.
Yeah.
Service Fabric running on your computer.
Yes. If I look at the node view here, you'll see that this is all sort of local
on
hosts.
Local host. Okay.
So you know, now I effectively have Service Fabric running, and I launched 5 fabric.exe processes. So it makes it look like a 5-node cluster, even though it's on my box. And that application I just built, application type 2, I create an instance of it all. And you'll see that Service Fabric decided to deploy it onto node number 1.
Okay.
And it thought that was the best one to run it on. And this is node number one that that application is running on.
Okay. So Service Fabric will monitor the resources on the cluster, and when you set the new service, it will try to make a best choice for you.
Yes.
Which node is free or available?
Yes, I mean, Service Fabric knows you can report from your service, and there are some defaults there, memory usage, disk usage, whatever usage that's interesting to you, network usage. And then across the cluster on the machines, we know how much machine is being utilized, and it'll make the best choice for it where it runs. So you get the optimal packing around those sort of things.
Okay.
If I just switch back to my view here, you'll see that you get these diagnostics information that comes out. You get this, if I just pause this diagnostics, you get these rich diagnostics that tell me about the name of my service, what node it was running on, and all of this is written out through ETW, and you can hook into this.
Cool.
And you know, to show some of the reliability features that it'll do to any piece of code, if I go inside here and decide to restart this particular machine, so I'm going to disable node number one inside here. As it starts to disable, and if you watch this instance here, it'll shut down node number one. And as it shuts down node number one,
It's gone.
It's gone, and you see now it's restarted on node number two.
Good guy, Service Fabric.
So machine died,
yeah.
But you don't have to care. It's like, oh, Service Fabric, or hit my breakpoint inside my code. If I switch back to my code view here and look at diagnostics, and if I just pause this for a moment, you'll see that my counter here was just going up to 114, 15, 116. And then there was this failover operation that happened here. Run async actually got shut down on a machine. Yep. Service Fabric chose to do a run async and start the service on another machine here. And because it was just a stateless service doing a counter, it starts up again here and going 1, 2, 3, and you load your data, and that's it. It's just a piece of code that runs.
I think that's like the best definition of what stateless and stateful will be.
Right there. Exactly there. So it just shows us. But it just shows how, you know, there's a stateless programming model. I can create all sorts of these different types, deploy them all, run them inside of my cluster, and I can see this reliability that happens inside here. I can go back and reactivate this particular node, and that will bring me back all five nodes running inside my cluster.
Cool.
So that's stateless. Let me switch back over to my slides here a moment. One thing that we think about a lot is in the stateless pattern that we talked about, you know, this is a very traditional pattern like cloud services where you have a web front end, you have your stateless nodes, you typically pull all your data from some storage. It's very common to put queues between your front end and your middle tier to make things reliable between them all, and then between the tiers themselves.
Yep.
You quite often have a caching tier inside them all.
Yeah.
And this is all a fine model to build on. We have many teams that build services like this that allow you to think about how your system runs. But we also found that there was another scenario that was very important, and that was what we now call stateful services, where we turn Service Fabric also into storage technology where you can make all the data reliable and highly available on the local cluster itself. And what that means now is that the data for your application, as well as the code for what you write, are stored on the same set of machines inside those cluster, those five machines. And this one's like, everyone goes, wow, the data's on the machines. Yes, and it's made fully reliable, it's fully consistent. Now we guarantee that that data is replicated and you don't have any data loss in your event of failures. And all of that gets exposed through a programming model. So what it means is that you can take these stateful services. It gives you advantage of low latency reads because you don't have to do network hops off to other systems. You can scale out and partition all this data. And there's built-in transactions to transact the data for that. And you end up with usually fewer moving parts in different designs. It's still very typical for you to take some of that data and push it into another store for analytics because you want to do queries and long-term data analysis on top of it all.
Okay.
But while your code is running, and your data is there, the stateful computer makes it very easier for your design and very low latency.
Yeah. I guess some of the customers, they were asking, say, if I have the state distributed in my computer nodes, how do I do my data backup? Is it the same way you push the data to some kind of a storage for data backup?
Yes, in the state, in case of all these stateful services, and they have a backup and restore API associated with them, you we're working to make this better, but right now you actually call, have to call a backup and restore API and take that data and put it to some external store. And this is a DR scenario. You know, the cluster has gone down. Actually, even if the cluster goes down and comes back up, your state is available. It's more like the machines have burned to the ground and, and disasters happen.
That's really bad.
And so you had to go and create another cluster and load your data over here. We're working to make this more integrated with Azure Backup and Restore so that it's automated for you in that terms of scenario. But yes, those are the things you have to consider.
I think like the biggest question here that sometimes I get asked is, how do you choose a good partition?
Yes. Yes, that's a actually generally building a scalable system as a whole. The biggest question that you have to start with yourself is talking about the capacity management of your system. Whether you're using Service Fabric or not, you generally have to think about how much data you store, how many transactions per second or requests per second you're going to deal with, how much state is in the application or stored elsewhere, and you have to think about how you do the partitioning around that. In this case, partitioning is a very application-centric thing. People partition on user ID, or they partition on, you know, maybe on the other indexes inside there.
Yes, pretty much. And well, I think like pretty much the thing behind that is that it's try and error, you know.
Yes,
most of the time.
We are actually providing there's some good guidance in our docs, and we're hoping to publish soon a spreadsheet and a tool that will help you go through thinking about your capacity management, how you do all of that. In fact, we're working on that at the moment.
Great.
So we end up with these two types of services, stateless and stateful. And let me go and show you what a stateful version. Let me do the hello world for stateful now.
Awesome.
And what that looks like. So I'm going to switch back to my dev machine here. Let's do file, new project here again. And we'll choose Service Fabric, and this time we'll choose Stateful Service. And let's go and see what that looks like. You'll see that it's very similar. In many ways, you have an application, you have a service that's deployed inside here again. Really, the difference when it comes down to it is that we derive from Stateful Service as the base class here. You'll see that, as before, there's the same way of communicating with your endpoint. It's just, here's my service. There's a run method here again. The difference this time, in terms of what you see, in terms of what you could do, is this very interesting line of code just here. In fact, when you point to this data structure here called Reliable Dictionary. And the concept of statefulness from a developer perspective is we wanted developers to be familiar with concepts they already knew, and they knew data structures like dictionary and queue. And so we introduced this concept of reliable dictionary. And in a reliable dictionary, you just put all your data inside this dictionary, and then Service Fabric does all the hard work of replicating that state onto other machines and making it reliable. So as a developer now, I can go into this dictionary, I can add new things, I can add accounts into this dictionary, I can update the value inside this dictionary. And interestingly, you'll see inside here, all of this is done inside a transaction. So I can have multiple updates, multiple deletes, and when I do this commit, I can guarantee that that dictionary and its state is transacted and complete. And if there's a failure that happens here, it all gets rolled back.
Awesome.
You also have reliable queues, right?
And we have reliable queues. So there's a sample I'll show you in a moment where you can pull data and put it inside a queue, and you pull it from reliable queues and put it inside a dictionary.
So from a developer's perspective, I'm just using it as a regular dictionary.
Yes.
And all the hard work is done by Service Fabric.
Exactly.
I guess this is somewhat different from the approaches from some other clusters like Kubernetes or Mesos, where they have this distributed data store, like a etcd on the cluster. But here, basically, each service, you can have your own reliable data store for yourself, right? It's not a global to the whole cluster.
Correct, yes. So in this particular case, I've written one particular service that has its own state made reliable for it. And I can have multiple of those dictionaries inside there if I wanted to. I can have a dictionary for, say, people and people for their addresses, and I can do a transaction across them all. But it's as you say, it's constrained within that particular service. So it's very localized, and it makes it very microservices oriented. This is my data, here's my code, here's my data. I've just deployed it all. And we find that people Developers love this because I don't have to set up SQL Server on my box anymore. I just write code, I just deploy, and there's my data and my code together made reliable. So I've deployed this onto my local cluster.
Oh, you already did that?
I just hit And if I go and look at my local cluster here again, and let me just refresh this because I can go and look at the applications. You'll see that this time is application type 3. Just as before, we deployed an instance here. But you see, before we just had a single instance running. Now I have this concept of a primary and secondaries. And this is transparent to the developer, but this has made my data replicated. My service has made copies of its data on other nodes inside the cluster, chosen for you. So as far as a developer is concerned, they don't see this.
And I guess you can control how many times your data is replicated as well?
Yes, you can say there's three replicas or four or five replicas. Or if you're really paranoid, you go to seven replicas.
I want a million replicas.
Well, I don't think you'd do that because I guess. Most of the time, three is good.
Because it will take also a lot of time to actually get all the replicas.
Yeah, well, this is a quorum-based system, so the number of replicas you have, in this case, when you have three replicas, we guarantee that at least one of the replicas has got a copy of the data before we update the primary and talk back to the secondary. If you say five replicas, we have to guarantee at least two, and then you pick the primary, which makes three is the quorum of them, and then you act back there. So you have to wait for these asynchronous acts to come back before you go back. That's how you provide the consistency guarantees. So it's a quorum-based system for all of this.
Always wanted to know that.
So here we go. So this is my primary. If I just go back and look at our diagnostics, by the way, just so let me start this diagnostics again. This time, I've got a new counter that started, but this is a counter for my stateful service, counting away here, 142, 143. But what I'm going to do now is, so I'm going to go, what is this, node two. So if I'm going to go here, I'm going to deactivate this node here. And as this node gets deactivated, you see now, see it switched, went to primary three. The primary now, they saw that node was shut down. We failed over to another machine. Code keeps running. If I go back and look inside here and just pause, you'll see that here I was, 159, 160. I did a failover operation here on my run async. I restarted my machine. This run async says, I'm going to pick the machine which had the most up-to-date copy of my data, and then everything keeps running again here, 62, 63. So now I haven't lost my data.
Yeah, and you even didn't even lost a single beat. It's 160, 160, 162.
Yes.
There's fully, no gap.
So that's the important thing about, you know, a lot of people talk about eventually consistent systems, and I just replicate some operations, and if I don't happen to replicate, or this machine goes down, and I lose an operation, that's fine. In this case, that's not fine. We make sure that there are guarantees. So we have people who built financial transaction systems on this.
Cool.
You know, because it provides us guarantees.
Once again, good guy, Service Fabric.
So let me just start this up here. So that's the statefulness inside here. You see that carries on and keeps running. And I can go back, and I'll just reactivate this node inside here again. I have an application deployed here called WordCount. And WordCount is not looking too happy at the moment because I've been shutting down nodes and things like that. But it still keeps running. It just shows you some warnings. Actually, this is a good example of you have this rich health data, which says, I have an unhealthy event that's happened on a node. It's telling you about the healthiness. You see it's now made it more healthy again because the node's come back up again. It's recovered. But all these health events have now disappeared. These health events get evaluated. And you can write your own health events out to say, what's the definition of my own health event and what makes it happy? These health events are built into all our upgrade mechanism. So you can say, I'm not going to roll out an application if it's not healthy, and healthy because it's you know, not got enough memory or whatever you like to think about that. But this word count application I've deployed here, it has a web front end and it has a back end. And here, my web front end, I've deployed a single instance, and my back end is running here. And if I go, actually, you can go and look at the web front end here, and you'll see that, you see, it even publishes the URL of where your web front end is running. So if I click on this, this is a web front end that I'm talking to, and it now talks to a number of, it's just started up here for the first time, it now talks to a number of partitions. I've partitioned my service with all my data here. So as random words get generated here, they get put into partition partition 1, partition 2, 3, 4, and 5. So like A, B, C, D go into partition 1, D, E, F go into next partition 2. Mm-hmm. And so all my data has been held inside here.
Right.
And that gets reflected in if I go back into this portal view here, in these partition services that I have at the back here that are running against all of that, where all of the data is held inside here. And this is the web front end around all of that. So let me just show back and click on that view again, which was here. So this is my example of how you can partition out your state across those stateful services and create any number of those partitions.
Cool. And
you can define those partitions declaratively. I can just say inside that manifest, I want 10 or I want 20. Of course, as you said earlier, I have to think about the logic of my partitioning. Mm-hmm. Here we partitioned on the first letter of the alphabet, where it went, but it might be zip code or it might be car ID or whatever else it is.
So in this case, the web front end is generating a random word, is sent to a particular partition, and the total you see, that's the state for that partition, right?
Correct, yes. That's the number of words that are in that particular partition.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's exactly right. And here's the random words being generated. And how they're being added to particular partitions around there in the total.
Cool.
This is one of the samples we have. If you go into, I think I had a link here. If you go into the Service Fabric Getting Started samples, one of our samples we have inside here was this one for word count. So you can download this, deploy it onto your local cluster, and see it all. In fact, I also have this. If I go into my remote cluster, I deployed word count here as well on my remote cluster running inside Azure. You'll see here when I deploy it inside Azure, the web front end got deployed across every one of the machines. Because when the load balancer request comes in, it'll hit the URL of one of those machines.
Okay.
So that's the difference. So Service Fabric is smart to know there's a cloud deployment and how I should activate a web instance across every machine as opposed to just having it on one machine.
Okay. Yeah, on the local cluster, you had one instance because to avoid the port conflicts, right? Because you can only have one instance listening to that port.
Yes.
Yeah.
How are we doing for time?
We are way over time, but let's just finish this.
Okay. All right.
This is good stuff. I don't want
great
to stop.
Stuff, yes. Okay. So one thing, and then I'll just talk through that's very important in that terms of application upgrade. Service Fabric allows you to have this image repository. You can deploy version 1 of your application and do an upgrade, and it roll through your application and do this rolling upgrade.
Yeah.
And that's a very key aspect. In fact, one of the hardest things you have inside a system is building your application and doing the versioning rollout.
Yeah.
And inside here, if I look at this. You see, I've been testing this before. If you look at my my visual objects one here, you see I've rolled out and deployed a number of different versions over time here. Mm-hmm. So I've got all these different versions from version 9 to version 1.
Okay.
And I can choose to roll forward or roll back these versions.
Oh, okay.
And all of these are kept as part of that image store repository keeps all of these things available inside here in terms of the binary packages.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key things is that you can decide when you do a rollout, if there's some failures because there's some health events, you can roll it all back again.
Can you put like a percentage of rollouts?
You can roll out on a per upgrade domain basis. So and you can set parameters inside as well. So you can say, if my application doesn't become healthy within 10 minutes, roll it back. Or even after it's become healthy, carry on doing some more checks before I move to the upgrade domain. You can do one upgrade domain and then just stop. Azure by default has 5 upgrade domains, so it ends up in the case of my 5 machine cluster, it would be on one machine.
Okay.
But if you had, say, a 20 machine cluster, it would be 4 machines, it would be a fifth of that.
So
the upgrade side of things and rolling out upgrades can all be done through either Visual Studio or most of the time there's PowerShell commands. And we've integrated all of this with VSTS, so you can push all of your code into VSTS, or you can do GitHub as well, but VSTS allows you to then have some build operations that do some builds and publish to your cluster. And if you go and read our docs, the life cycle of building an application, deploying it to VSTS, doing a build inside VSTS and then publishing to a cluster allows you to do the DevOps and automation around that, the CI/CD.
Cool.
That's something we're spending a lot of time working on, so we get the seamless operation for that. Okay, we use Service Fabric to build lots and lots of our own services. Azure databases, back in Bing Cortana, DocDB, Intune, Power BI, IoT suite. So we're very committed to the platform because we've used it ourselves. We have lots.
So although many people may know Swiss Fabric as a new service, but this one is actually already battle tested with our own platforms and services.
It is. I mean, we've built Service Fabric over many years and built it over many, used it in many services ourselves. And so that's a lot of battle testing of the system itself and the infrastructure has been happened in our own service. And we rolled it out into our own services to test it first before we released the SDK.
And I see you have a long list of customers here.
We have a long list of customers. Some great case studies. If you go to the Service Fabric team blog and look that up and search for it, you'll see that we've written a lot of case studies around some of these. For mesh systems, TalkTalk. We're just publishing a BMW case study this week of how they built their app using our Actor programming model. And they used an actor to represent a driver. And they've been very successful with this. It's an app that they have on their mobile phone that tracks where you're going. And shows a history of all your routes that you've driven and gives you advice on when to leave. Good. It's very clever.
Cool.
With Service Fabric, we release updates every month, and in Azure, we do upgrades to those clusters, a new SDK with features about every 8 weeks. We're just moving towards, in the next couple of months, to release Service Fabric as a GA on standalone server. Service Fabric will be included as part of Azure Stack. And as coming up in another of the these cloud news. Covers is the Linux and what that looks like. And we're super excited about Linux.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
You'll see many of the same things, but you'll have a different tool set of how you do all of this and use it all. Running on Linux, on Ubuntu at the moment, but we're targeting many other SKUs. And this is a list of great resources that a developer can do to get started. Particularly of interest is that we have this link here, which is a lab that you can run through. That's actually on our team blog. If you're looking for the Service Fabric team blog, you can start off by going through this lab, and it helps you walk through building your first service from scratch, as well as some great
I also would like to add to those resources that the guy right here, Hashi, has his own book. Microsoft Azure Service Fabric. So now you guys know. This is the guy who talks.
We'll have a link to the book as well. So this link's at the bottom of the.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I forgot to put your book.
No. Yeah.
You need to sell a few of those.
So, it's an amazing book.
I need to bring you more on the show.
So that's what I have, Service Fabric. It's a great platform for developers to build these scalable cloud-native applications. We use it to build our own systems. We're having some tremendous growth with inside it that we're seeing. There's all sorts of topics we can cover that you're going to cover. Particularly, we looked at the developer side of here, our programming models. I didn't show today how you can bring your own code, but that's another thing that you can do. And of course, you know, you also can package things inside containers and deploy all of those, which we're going to do in another topic.
Awesome. We'll cover all that. So in addition to these resources, do you have, do the team have a Twitter handle that you can share?
Yes, if you, the Twitter handle is hash Azure Service Fabric.
You need to do this.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a hash Azure Service Fabric.
Yeah.
Cool.
So hold us long enough. And yes, you can go there, and that's our Twitter handle. And we tweet a lot about how we release new blogs. Lots of other the community are putting a lot of their work that they're doing inside there. People are publishing a lot of NuGet packages and a lot of GitHub packages of things that they're deploying. And every month we roll that all up and send out the hashtag about what's happening.
Cool.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for viewing this episode. Like I said, we'll have more episodes on Service Fabric coming. Thank you very much. See you.